Janice felt the energy in the room gathering, or curdling into something thick, an unseeable partition gelling between Tanya and Cameron. He fished a cigarette from his pack. Tanya was standing by the front door with an ashen, seasick look on her face. "But," she said, without finishing. "What am I supposed to do?" he asked her. "Just hole up? Until what, huh? Hide? From who? From me?"
"I just don't want people hurting you, baby,"
Tanya said, stepping forward, then back. "Am I really gonna get hurt worse," he said, "than I've already hurt?" Janice's head was swiveling blankly between them.
"It's different," Tanya begged. "It ain't the same, Cam."
Cameron closed his eyes, summoning or evicting something from what looked to be deep within. He lit the cigarette, letting the smoke curl from between his lips. "This ain't your story either, Dan," he said, Janice unable to follow. "It's mine. It's mine now." Tanya looked steamrolled, the color of her face alternating from red to green, like dying Christmas bulbs, and her body swaying, or rather heaving, side to side. Janice instinctively searched the room for a pot or a planter she could grab if Tanya began to vomit. Having arrived here directly from a deathbed, Janice's gut was telling her she was witnessing another kind of death, though she couldn't say precisely who or what was dying. Some kind of cord, maybe, that had connected brother and sister for nearly a quarter century, severing right before her eyes.
"I've been protecting you since the day you was born," Tanya told Cameron,
brandishing the stack of prescriptions in her hand as convenient proof, shaking them at him. Her eyes were spearing him.
"Everything I ever done been to protect you, to take care of you. Who you think changed your diapers when Mama couldn't lift her ass off the floor? Who you think put food on the table after Mama died? Who's the one stayed up till 2 in the morning writing your term papers? Who's the one stayed in San Antonio when you come back nothing but bandages? The one carried you in and out of bed when you couldn't do it yourself? Cleaned the pressure wounds on your ass? Cried when you was crying? Who's the one gave up every fucking thing but you for 4 years? 4 fucking years, Cam! You want to look at something? You want to look at something? Look at me!"
She punched herself in the chest 3 times, each punch expelling a sob.
"Look at me!"
she repeated weakly. Tanya dropped her gaze and let out a high-pitched moan, as though horrified by the emotions she'd spilled onto the floor. Cameron's mouth remained fixed in a tight straight line, yet another flat horizon, while his derelict cigarette was burning itself out in the ashtray. Janice's thoughts swirled as an incoming text message pinged her cell phone. Nap, almost certainly. The sound jolted her, a psychic alarm clock reminding her why she was here.
"Is there something I should know?"
she asked Cameron, registering the absurdity of the question as she asked it. The last 3 minutes, to her, might as well have been conducted in Latin. Cameron stared flatly at Janice, barely breathing.
"About your recovery?" she pressed.
A rubbery scowl flashed onto Cameron's face, his bottom lip flopping down.
"My recovery?"
Firmly, trying to look wise to him, she nodded.
"My recovery?"
he echoed once more, trying to hammer the phrase into something coherent. His confusion looked thorough.
"Nothing I ain't told you about that." "You're telling me,"
Janice said, the pitching and rising and faltering of her voice reflecting the unruly muddle of her thinking,
"that the way it happened, it was just like you said?"
"Yes, ma'am," he said. And when he leaned toward her, the whole room seemed to shift with him, exerting all its weight upon Janice. "Where are you coming from?"
"Where I'm coming from," she said, her words feeling disconnected, like she was reading from a script that her brain's higher powers had already discarded. "It's a medical opinion that says the only explanation for your recovery is that you couldn't have been paralyzed the morning of August 23rd before you stood out of your chair."
"What?" Tanya squealed, taking a menacing step forward. Janice was suddenly seized by a very real and physical fear, apprehending in that instant that her indignation over Hat's grief had completely warped her judgment. She should never have come here to confront Cameron. She'd neglected to even consider Tanya. Not alone, and not when Cameron was already tottering in the aftermath of violence, after he just proved his potential for coming unhinged. She should have left this to the Vatican investigator, or, as Knapp suggested, taken her suspicions to the U.S. Attorney's office.
She was pregnant, she remembered. Not as a fact, but as a vulnerability spiking her fear. She was pregnant. And she was also, if what everything Cameron's wet eyes were telling her was true, wrong.
You're my doctor, he said feebly.
His voice reeled back 20 years to that of a small boy facing broken trust for the very first time, not knowing how to withstand it. Janice looked away. She couldn't bear the way he was searching her face. I am your doctor, Cameron, I am, she said, struggling to engineer some way out of this place she'd cornered herself in, feeling Tanya moving heavily behind her, then deciding, without really deciding, just to lay it all out there, to confess, as Cameron had asked, where she was coming from. And that's why I've spent these last 4 months ramming my head into every brick wall I've been able to find, trying to help you and me, yes, me too, understand why you're walking. And the only thing that's made any sense to me at all, the only thing I found I could actually explain, was something happening up there, pointing up to his head, then dragging her finger down to his legs. And not there. A long silence gripped the room, as a weird reversal set in. Janice seemed the wounded one, voice fraying, eyes imploring, while Cameron regarded her with the tender sturdiness of a country doctor.
I can't tell if you're saying I'm a liar or I'm crazy.
His face twitched with something approaching a smile.
But I know I ain't one, and I don't think I'm the other.
It was real, Janice said, as barely a question. Cameron bobbed his head, staring her square in the eyes.
I don't know what it was, but it was real.
Then what was all that? She pleaded. You and Tanya, what was that?
That?
He glanced at Tanya.
That ain't about here or here,
he said to Janice, touching his head, then his legs. He tapped his chest.
That's about here.
I gotta get out, Tanya suddenly groaned. I'm going. Her gaze swung around the room until she noticed the prescriptions in her hand. I'm going to the drugstore. The solidity Janice had seen in Cameron was only growing denser and harder. Something had happened to him since she'd arrived, whether because of her or in spite of her, Janice didn't know. She watched him pin his sister with a stare.
No, Tan, he said. Stay. You ain't heard but a little of it. You only heard the part about Landry. There's something more.
Tanya stood fastened to the doorway. I can't, came out of her. Not even a whisper, just a breath. Her hand found the doorknob, cranked it sideways.
You can, her brother said softly.
Please. She left. To the drugstore first, then to anywhere else but home. Cameron sank his head into his hands, and then after fetching himself a Bud Light, he told his doctor a story, a long story, his, beginning in Biloxi, Mississippi in the 1990s, and ending with a white flash and soundless blackness on a ridge in Zabul Province, Afghanistan. Its latter part, the flip side of the same story that 2 weeks earlier, DeMarcus Lockwood had told Euclide Abasha inside that mobile home in the backwoods of White County, Georgia.
Before, Part 4. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be condemned. Chapter 18. Family military tradition played no role in Cameron Harris's enlistment in the Army in April 2009. Sneed Harris never served. And while the Navy drafted Randall Polk Harris, Cameron's grandfather, in 1952, going AWOL 3 times yielded him what was then called an undesirable discharge. Beyond this, the ancestral trail goes cold, until we come to Rufus Little Harris, who seated the Harris family in Stone County, Mississippi, after deserting the 15th Confederate Cavalry Regiment during a skirmish in Louisiana, a dubious antecedent. Patriotic zeal factored only lightly. Cameron was 13 years old on September 11, 2001, old enough to feel horror and a jumbled kind of fury, but young enough that by the time he turned 20, The events of that day felt distant and dry, and bore almost the most oblique of connections to the war in Iraq, the fight Cameron was expecting to join. To his sister and his friends, and sometimes to himself, Cameron parroted his recruiter's reasons for enlisting. Job skills training, seeing what the world looks like outside of Mississippi, getting his body back in shape after 3 years without football. His true reason for enlisting, however, didn't crystallize in his mind until the first time he stood alone, in front of a full-length mirror, dressed in his combat uniform. He found himself smiling at his reflection, suffused with a profound but secret peace. He was indistinguishable from everyone else, identical down to his fingernail length to every other soldier in his basic training unit. Not one thing set him apart. He was finally and ecstatically normal. Cameron can't pinpoint when normality became something elusive to him. The earliest difference from other children that he can recall involves his father, or his lack thereof. Many of his classmates had divorced parents, some seeing their fathers only on weekends, and a couple fathers were dead. But Cameron was the only one, so far as he could tell, whose father's absence was willful, the only child whose father explicitly didn't want him. Yet his mother, and especially his big sister, served to counterbalance that in his mind. When other kids bitched about their older siblings, Cameron rarely had anything to add, less a difference in his mind than an advantage. Still, he disliked standing out. His report cards might have been different, he thinks, had that been otherwise. C-grade work was what he shot for, because C equaled average, and therefore drew no attention. Scoring A's could get you lauded, horrifically, in front of the whole class. D's and F's got you miserable conferences with school counselors, but C's almost magically got you nothing. Befriending Bucky Petts in the third grade triggered a seismic shift. Bucky, asthmatic and Jewish and chubby and black-haired, Cameron's opposite in almost every regard, introduced Cameron to the board game Hero Quest and to obscure movies, and most notably to theater. Cameron's interest in the latter came as a smack of surprise to his sister and mother. He recalls his mother, as she was nervously writing out the check for his after-school drama classes, warning him that he couldn't act my normal way up there, couldn't be shy. But drawing attention on stage, he found, was different than in life. You weren't you up on stage. You were a character, and nothing you said or did revealed or betrayed anything inside of you, or at least, that's how it felt to him. Your character could be peculiar, foolish, a brute or a sissy, fiercely loved or bleakly unloved, yet beneath the mask you were wearing, be it actual or invisible, you remained you, as ordinary as you wished to be, operating your stage self as if by remote control. Bucky Petts was Cameron's conduit to this sorcery, and their attendant friendship was in many ways idyllic. When not filming movies about sand monsters and Civil War spies, they fished for croaker and teased girls and planted items on the railroad tracks for the trains to flatten. They watched Dukes of Hazzard reruns on TV, Cameron conscious only in retrospect that Bucky would lean closer when Daisy Duke appeared on screen, while he'd lean closer for Beau and Luke. Aside from what Cameron felt for his mother and Tanya, and the memory of his dog Lucky, his friendship with Bucky was the closest thing to love he'd known. That Bucky's move to Florida coincided so precisely with Cameron entering puberty seems like a cruel twist of fate in a short life overriddled with such twists, its arc shaped like a spring. Almost overnight, it seemed, Cameron found himself not just alone, but equipped with a deep new voice and deeper new feelings that he didn't recognize. Many, if not most people, look back upon middle school with cringing, but Cameron's climb was particularly steep. "Are there any girls at school you like?" he recalls his mother asking, striving to be casual and cool when he was in eighth grade. He told her, no, that he didn't really like girls in that way. Cameron intuitively understood the reason she greeted his answer with such festive relief, despite his tufted armpits and baritone voice. His lack of attraction to girls meant he was still her little boy, her miracle baby, that he'd yet to be stricken with the goatish desires of men. He allowed her to think this, of course, all the while knowing how much more complicated his answer was. The reason girls didn't attract him was because boys did. Cameron grumbled and pouted about his mother thrusting him into football the following summer, until discovering it provided him an ideal distraction. Soon he was throwing all his energy into it, exhausting his body so thoroughly as to deprive it of the scant vigor required for sexual urges. More importantly, he says, football furnished him an identity. You couldn't be a faggot and a football standout. That had never happened, not in Mississippi or anywhere else. And game by game, catch by catch, Cameron Harris was quickly becoming not just a standout, but a junior varsity star. Something about playing football, he says, was akin to acting on stage. Out on the field, suited up in his helmet and pads and red and white uniform, he felt detached from the person inside, as though transformed into the uniform itself, an avatar speaking in a language of passes caught and yardage gained, his every line scripted in a whiteboard pattern of X's and O's. His on-field successes allowed him to project a resemblant character off the field, but still, he says, he was obsessively cautious. Some teachers, coaches, and especially fellow students thought him slow-witted because of his sluggardly delivery and his ceaselessly furrowed brow. But his wits were fine. He just dripped them through a thick, heavy filter. I've heard Tanya say I don't got any gut instincts, that the way I decide everything is like a cow chewing cud, he says. But that ain't really it. I always had a gut. Everyone does. But mine couldn't be trusted. Whatever my gut was telling me had to be checked. Most of the time it had to be resisted. Everything below the neck was always conflicting with what's above. Cameron knew he was attracted to boys and not girls, but also felt certain he wasn't gay. This might strike some as an absurdly semantic distinction, but for a 15-year-old football player in South Mississippi, it felt neither semantic nor absurd. It felt like the difference between life and death. He knew he wasn't gay because he didn't act anything like the gay men he listened to his teammates imitate or saw on television, not the urbane and compulsively dowdy Will on the sitcom Will and Grace, certainly not Will's swishy friend Jack. He hated dancing and was bad at it anyway. He liked sappy country ballads, yeah. George Jones could make him cry almost on command. But club pop and most show tunes left him cold. He was tough. And that toughness felt essential to him, not as a cover, but as an intrinsic and defining aspect of who and what he was. It was almost like certain black dudes I knew growing up, he says, who'd look at these other black dudes, you know, the ones with their shorts dragging low, riding around in their hoopties, all that gangster shit, and be like, man, I'm black, but I sure ain't that. But that's kind of how it is when you're 15, 16. You don't know what you are. So you start drawing these crazy lines everywhere, you know, saying I'm this, but I ain't that. So for me, liking guys instead of girls, that was one thing. That was this below-the-neck thing I could maybe tune out if I tried hard enough. But being gay? Man. I mean, just listen how that sounds. Being gay. Being. That was going all in. That was... Cameron shivers his head. That just wasn't anything like an option. To Cameron's knowledge, there were no openly gay students at Biloxi High School while he was there. Other students say there was a quietly out lesbian. But as with any high school, past or present, there were plenty of students suspected of being gay. Some of these fell into the obvious suspects lineup, their supposed orientations deduced via the age-old tea leaves of stereotype. The more debonair boys in drama club. The square-shouldered members of the girls' sports teams. Others fell into a murkier zone, boys whose masculinity measure failed to meet some other boys' or boys' standard. One of these was a new student, one of the so-called military brats who pass in and out of Biloxi schools because of Keesler Air Force Base. He was a member of the tennis team, Cameron recalls, and an occasional but peripheral presence at the beach parties the school's athletes held at the Biloxi piers, seen usually in the company of girls. Three members of the varsity football squad, a senior and two juniors, took Cameron aside at one such party during the spring of Cameron's freshman year. They liked his skills, they said. Coach Niekase was talking him up for varsity. Mumbling thanks, Cameron felt his chest swelling into something like a pigeon's plenteous breast, his feathers fluffing. But he wasn't playing varsity yet, they told him, not without passing his initiation first. With a gulp, Cameron asked what that was.
You gotta smear a queer for real,
one said, the others nodding gravely. Cameron stood blinking at them, not understanding what they meant. Smear the Queer was a playground game from elementary and middle school. He remembers a P.E. teacher saying the game's name wasn't nice, jokingly telling the kids to rename it Tackle the Alternative Lifestyle, but also feeling terrified by this huddled mention of queerness.
You see that fag right over there?
They were pointing to the tennis player.
Just walk up to him, tell him he's a faggot, and take him out.
Punch him? Cameron asked, the three of them falling out laughing.
Yeah, they told him. Drop that mother.
He wonders in aching retrospect whether their suspicions were really about him, whether this ostensible initiation might have been a version of that classic movie scene in which a suspected spy is ordered to kill an enemy prisoner in order to prove his fealty. The situation felt to Cameron just as fraught as that scene. To say no to them meant more than scuttling or risking his chances to make the varsity squad. It meant outing himself on some level. Sympathy for a fag equal to being one, in Cameron's read of their eyes. The solution seems so simple, he says now. You just say, dudes, I'm not hitting that guy. I don't even know him. But that escape didn't even occur to him then, blotted out by fear. So much, the identity he'd constructed, his football future, his quivering sense of manhood, felt precariously balanced upon obeying this order. He looked over at the tennis player, awash in a sea of girls, and went shuffling toward him through the sand. He couldn't bring himself to do it out in the open, the way they'd instructed him.
Hey, man, he muttered to the boy. I want to talk to you about something.
Leading him down to the surf's edge, a dark distance away from the party. He told himself this was to spare the boy humiliation, but it was also, he admits, to protect himself from shame and scorn. He was too afraid to glance back, but felt sure the three players were following, positioned a little way up the beach. He sensed their eyes zapping his back like cattle prods. It occurred to him to quickly explain his dilemma to the boy and ask him to take a stage fall. But then why would the boy grant him that bizarre favor? And what would stop him from telling people about it? And how could Cameron divulge to the boy that a committee of upperclassmen had branded him a fag? That seemed a more lasting cruelty, an injection of slow-acting poison. They were standing alone at the lapping edge of the water, a frothy black tide coming in, a sliver of moon casting just the faintest blue glow on the boy's quizzical and expectant face. The boy was hiding his braces behind plummy lips, a timid curiosity peeping out of his dark eyes. And he was beautiful, Cameron saw. More beautiful even than that thin white hook of a moon. Footage from an alternative universe flashed onto the screen of his mind. Cameron seeing himself leaning in for a kiss, draping a hand on the tennis player's shoulder, the shorter boy hoisting himself up on his toes in the foamy tide to meet Cameron's lips with his own. But this was not the universe Cameron inhabited. He didn't know if it ever would or could be, nor did he know if he truly wanted it to be. He bunched his hand into a fist and drove it into the boy's stomach. Not nearly as hard as he could have, but hard enough for the boy's breath to fly from his mouth and for his body to jackknife and for him to collapse to his knees in the shallow surf. Cameron tried not to look at the boy, glancing up the beach to make sure the varsity players had just witnessed it. Frustratingly unable to make them out in the gloom of the distant crowd. But Cameron did catch one searing glimpse. The boy clutching his belly and staring up at him with a shapelessly stricken look, less pained than disillusioned. Just stay down for a while, Cameron whispered sharply, adding as he turned to walk away. I'm really sorry. Whether the varsity players actually saw him do it was never clear. They acted pleased and surprised that Cameron went through with it, shepherding him to the more central upperclassman zone of the party and forcing an acclamatory shot of Everclear on him. Cameron never saw if the boy returned to the party, and for the next 2 years, until the boy's family decamped to another base town somewhere, Cameron couldn't bring himself to meet the boy's eyes when passing him in the hallway, or while in the two classes he ended up sharing with him. Mostly from shame, but also from fear. Packed into Cameron's fist and transmitted in that brute snap of contact had been Cameron's deepest secret. It didn't matter if the boy couldn't decode it. He possessed it now, and that possession gave him immense, even immeasurable power over Cameron. With a single dark-eyed stare, he could have broken Cameron in two. Cameron tried one other thing that following autumn to fend off his heart's and body's cravings. He let a senior cheerleader take his virginity. Little besides terror flowed through him the entire time. He felt sure that something he did or didn't do would give him away, that at some point the cheerleader would suddenly freeze the action and with a look of scowling appraisal say to him, "Wait, are you gay?" To maintain his pelvic focus, he concentrated on the parts of her that were least female, bestowing inordinately rapt attention upon her shoulders and clavicle bones. When it was over, he felt not just emptied, but empty, as though like Sisyphus in the myth he'd been studying in school, he'd just pushed a boulder uphill only to watch it roll back down. His unease was palpable enough that the cheerleader, reputed to be wise in matters sexual, pressed a fingertip of concern against his cheek and asked if he was okay. "Yeah," he said. "I'm great." But realizing how untrue this was, and how clearly the cheerleader could see that, he devised a quick explanation, casting a flashlight beam of irony toward future events. "It's just, you know, us not being married and all. Maybe I'm just a little wigged out about the whole religious thing." He can still hear her laugh today. So feline, so sugared, so tender, so generous, so unbearably scalding. The text messages started coming in May of Cameron's sophomore year, the first one popping onto Cameron's phone a day after the football team's spring intra-squad game. "It was just a nondescript feeler," Cameron says. "What's up?" or something of that nature. He tapped a response. "Who's this?" Cameron's phone was a singular clamshell handset his mother had bought him for his birthday 2 months before. A green glow pulsed slowly from the top screen when messages came in. "Christy," came the answer. "Christy who? How'd you get my number?" "I saw you play yesterday. You're awesome." "Thanks. Can I put something out there?" "I guess." A few minutes passed before the phone glowed green again. "I have a seriously massive crush on you." Cameron wasn't terribly interested, not at first, for reasons extending beyond his sexual confusion. This had the makings of a come-on from a certain variety of girl, derided by his teammates as jersey chasers or jocksuckers, that didn't just cozy up to standout athletes, but tried to collect them as flesh-and-blood playing cards, some of them more spookily fluent with a player's stats than he himself was. Even for his straight teammates, these girls held limited appeal. As Cameron understood it, you hooked up with one of them after exhausting all other options, and come Monday acted sheepish about it, as though explaining that every other movie was sold out to justify why you were spotted exiting a Jennifer Aniston rom-com. Still, Cameron didn't mind the compliments and gushing flattery, the random little flashbulbs of attention, enough to play along anyway. As the texts continued, though, he began doubting his presumption of a jersey chaser. Christy was way too coy for that. Wouldn't divulge her last name, or where she lived or attended school, and said she couldn't talk to him on the phone, could only text, but wouldn't say why. Once she let slip an offhand reference to a boyfriend, adding a low-voltage current of something illicit to the exchange. The texts came at all hours, usually in unpredictable bursts. Most of them, Cameron says, amounted to mundane chit-chat. "I'm bored," Christy would often begin. "What are you doing?" Gradually, though, a picture began emerging. Christy's parents were divorced, and she hated shuttling between her mom's house and her dad's. She loved the show Grey's Anatomy, but was put out with the book Wuthering Heights, which she was reading for school. She had an older brother in college at the University of Alabama, which was where she thought Cameron should play football,
As if, he texted back. And the love of her life was a little dog named Maybelle, whose greetings to Cameron she sometimes playfully transcribed as yips and barks. Cameron told her he loved dogs, but after losing Lucky, his mom was afraid to get him another. Music was a frequent topic. It turned out Christy dug a lot of the same classic country he did, the stuff Tanya sniffed at as nursing home country. Christy got him to confess that his all-time favorite artist, the one he'd go back to see perform live if he had access to a time machine, was Patsy Cline, something he'd deemed too effeminate to ever reveal to anyone else. Christy adored Patsy Cline. She also adored Broadway musicals, she wrote. He told her he didn't as much, but admitted he knew the lyrics to every song from Fiddler on the Roof, admitting further, when she pressed, his appearance in a youth production 5 years before. After breaking off the exchange for dinner, she came back later to ask if he liked Matchmaker, one of the musical's frillier songs, sung by three sisters pining for their shtetl's matchmaker to find them husbands to love. Not really my favorite, he wrote back. I wish I could hear you sing it, Christy wrote. I bet you sing it so beautifully. Late that night, alone in the house, Cameron found himself humming the song, and then after a while, absently stitching the lyrics onto the melody, and then, propelled by something fluid and ecstatic inside him that he was unable to keep bottled, singing, and then flat out belting the song with a felicity and effervescence he didn't know he possessed. A South Mississippi football player in his boxer briefs, leaping onto the furniture and dancing through the rooms of the house, clutching one of his mother's lighthouse quilts around his head like the babushkas the three girls in his production wore, and begging like them for a match, for a catch, for the loneliness to somehow end. As May turned to June, the throbbing green glow of his phone was triggering spurts of anticipatory delight. When the messenger was anyone besides Christy, such as his mom or one of his teammates, he'd frown glumly at the phone, curdling with disappointment. Christy's presence in his life as a phantom, as a kind of genie wholly contained inside that phone, made him loose and incautious with her. It wasn't anonymity, for sure. It felt almost as liberating. Occasionally he chided himself for letting his guard fall too low, pricked by abrupt fears. Christy could be the quarterback's girlfriend Marissa, whose eye was rumored to be ever-wandering, which would explain her unwillingness to talk. Or anyone else, for that matter. Anyone whose text messages, if discovered and read by the wrong eyes, could doom him on several levels. Yet it was like he'd threaded some impossible needle, to crib a football saying. He had a sort of girlfriend who wasn't technically a girl. She was a girl, yes. But the only thing tangible of her was her words. And words were just words, neither male nor female. And appearing the way they did on his phone, they were pitchless and sexless, unyoked even from the differing vocal folds of men and women. And therefore, his to hear how he wanted to hear them. He didn't want to meet Christy. He didn't want to hear her voice. He wanted her to stay just the way she was, nebulous, ethereal, a romantic abstract, a perfect vessel of disembodied intimacy. And then, Cameron remembers, came a stormy June night. He was out on the screened-in back porch that used to hang off the back end of the house prior to Hurricane Katrina, doing homework at a folding table and listening to the approaching mutters of thunder. Inside the house, his mother was cleaning up after dinner, the faucet running, dishes clinking against silver, a slow, soft-rock bass line slithering from the living room stereo. His mom's boyfriend, Jim Yarbrough, was over that night, shuffling cards with a cigarette clamped half-dashingly, half-goofily between his front teeth. He was wanting to teach Debbie some two-person Italian card game he knew, but she was cheerily objecting, saying he was just going to win anyway, so why teach her the rules? A close crack of lightning startled Cameron. And before he'd even recovered, a shock of rain drenched the house. Not as drops or even sheets, but as a kind of tremendous block of water that shivered the porch's roof struts and instantly swamped the gutters. Just then his phone buzzed, throwing up its emerald glow. "Are you there?" It was Christy. "I have to tell you something." "Okay," he texted back. "I don't go to Biloxi High School," she wrote.
He held the phone in his hand as the glow faded, sensing a disturbance about to come. But then she'd never actually claimed to go to Biloxi High. In fact, he'd kind of pegged her for a Long Beach girl. So what did this matter? A quake of thunder shook the house, a shimmery pewter blur of rain and gutter runoff cloaking his view beyond the screens. "And my name's not Christy." Not a big deal also, he thought. He'd half suspected as much. "It's Chris." He didn't so much stare at the phone as let the phone stare at him. The crackling air felt ionized by the thunderstorm, but the storm had a stench to it, as if the neighborhood were being sloshed with recycled water sucked from a stagnant pool. "I'm a guy." He covered the phone with his hand, throwing a sharp glance inside to where his mom sat, with four fanned cards in one hand and a cigarette in her other, laughing at something Jim was telling her. A fresh glow of green seeped between Cameron's fingers. "Are you there?" "I'm here," he wrote. Deleted it. Tap, tap, tap. Wrote it again. "Are you mad?" Was he mad? No, he was sweating. He was sweating so suddenly and profusely, and felt so much electrical force whirling through him, that in that moment the storm seemed centered inside him, instead of in the dank cloud deck outside, with every length of gutter on Reconfort Avenue brimming because of him. "No, it's cool," he wrote back, at the moment thinking more of Chris's predicament than of his own. Cameron's fingers were being piloted by compassion at this point, and by admiration as well. What Chris was doing, he realized, was gutsier than anything he could even imagine himself doing. Bulging the cockpit door, however, were other, more selfish feelings, gathering quick and riotous might. "It's cool, really? I can still have a crush on you?" Cameron's hand blanketed the screen again, a grin splashing onto his face. The closest thing he'd ever had to a girlfriend had turned out to be, holy shit, a boyfriend. He laughed aloud, then brought the phone to his lips to hush himself. Nothing about what he wrote back felt reckless. Just the opposite, in fact. He felt anesthetized by the safety and relief of voicing something true. "Only if I can have a crush on you back," he wrote, sealing it. And then, like that, Chris disappeared. Cameron waited. "Are you there?" Cameron texted. He waited a while longer. "Can we finally talk?" The storm was passing now, drifting inland, towing a wet tumble of vapors in its wake, stray gusts of wind drawing the screens in and out like bellows. "Chris?" Cameron cursed himself, flinging his phone across his homework. He'd gone and scared him, he figured. Christy/Chris had always been the flirty one, Cameron having always been playing down in a lower key, and that burst of reciprocal affection. It must have just freaked him out, Cameron decided. He tried to envision what Chris was doing now, maybe recoiling from his phone like someone who just fired a weapon he'd thought was unloaded, terrified by the unexpected bang, panickedly assessing the damage. They'd both just outed themselves, and if Chris was anything like Cameron, he probably hadn't ever done that before. Lost upon Cameron was the fact that the outing had not been mutual. Chris knew precisely who Cameron Harris was, but to Cameron, Chris was just Chris, still just a phantom. The only other new detail added to his identity chromosomal. Cameron texted Chris one last time that night. "I'll be here whenever," and set his phone beside the pillow, hoping he'd be roused from sleep, hoping to wake to the sight of his bedroom walls bathed in pulses of dim green light. Chris didn't text back until three nights later. It was late, past midnight. "Send me a picture," Chris wrote. "You know what I look like," Cameron answered. "Please, Chris, come on, what's going on?" That "please" was the last text message Cameron ever received from Chris. Cameron wrote back to him. "Are you there? What happened? I'm sorry if I did anything." Without ever hearing back. After 1 a.m., Cameron finally tried calling him to talk. The call went to a generic voicemail greeting, and Cameron didn't leave a message. He dozed into a daydreamy half-sleep with his phone cradled in his palm. At 4 a.m., he texted him once more. If I call again, will you answer? He slept through his 6:30 alarm, missing his daily morning routine of jogging to the high school to run up and down the bleachers. When he finally wakened, his mom mussed his blonde hair while pouring him a bowl of Wheaties and laughed that he looked like he'd seen a ghost. 3 days later, she was dead. During the 48 hours he spent holed up in his bedroom, when Tanya feared he might die from sobbing, he wrote to Chris one last time. My mother was the one in that wreck on I-10. She died. I don't know what to do. But Chris's silence was final. The phone stayed dim. Cameron gave up after that. Nothing Chris could say or do or be was going to revive his crushed heart anyway. What he had to do now, before anything else, was learn how to survive without his mother. That meant learning how to cook when Tanya was off at work. It meant learning how to operate the washer and dryer. It meant remembering to turn down the air conditioning before he went to sleep every night, and to water the lantana and the jessamine out front if they got dry. It meant learning how to walk past his mom's collection of porcelain dolphins and crabs and crawfish and seahorses without exploding into spasms of enraged wet grief and shaking the cabinet so violently that everything else she'd loved would be as shattered as he was. He was no longer anyone's boy, which meant he had to learn how to be a man, whatever in God's name that was. Until his mother's death, Cameron had mostly shied away from alcohol. For one thing, it messed with his athletic training and performance. After the first time he tried scaling the bleachers at dawn with a hangover, his body exuding sweat that smelled like kerosene, and his muscles groggy and unresponsive, he vowed it would be his last. But he also feared the lack of control alcohol fomented. His inhibitions weren't merely inhibitions. They were a means of survival. And even after nights with his teammates, when he'd nursed just one or two beers to give the appearance of macho drinking, the following morning would find him replaying the entire evening in his head, anxiously reviewing it for any slips he might have made. His mother's death changed that. He craved the numbness alcohol delivered, the way it temporarily caulked all the cracks in his heart. Getting drunk crooked his mother's death off stage and narrowed his focus to the immediate here and now. For a dark but brief period, a little more than a year later, smoking crystal meth would supply Tanya with a similar solace. At one beach party in July, he got drunk enough to rally two girls into attempting a half-mile, nude, midnight swim out to Deer Island. The three of them didn't make it far, and unable to find the clothes he'd shed, Cameron spent the rest of the party wearing only a borrowed towel, his teammates repeatedly yanking it down, Cameron flagrantly unconcerned. Then came August 21st, an unruly Saturday night. Nearly the entire football roster was there, funneling beers, throwing back shots of coconut rum, chanting the fight song, tackling one another in the surf, pumping themselves up for the season opener against St. Martin. But this was way more than a football cheer squad party. Half the school appeared to be there. Stoners, preps, band geeks, emos, hippies and hipsters, gangsters and wangsters, everyone. Plus a contingent of college-age folks, Tanya among them, though Cameron wasn't aware of this, throwing a semi-adjacent party a little way down the sand. The night was hot, the crowd muggy, but someone started a bonfire anyway. Cameron had never funneled a beer before, and when the beer erupted onto his shirt, he threw the shirt off and pounded his hairless, sudsy chest and called for a do-over. He was pumped more than most for the coming football season. He was looking forward to it, driving and occupying not just his schedule and his body, but his mind as well. To football slapping a lid onto his rolling boil of grief and confusion. Tommy Landry called him over. Cameron didn't know Landry all that well. He knew he was a senior outfielder on the baseball team. Reputedly a clutch hitter, but he was also aware of Landry as someone to avoid. Landry was known to have a mean streak dating way back. It wasn't a physical mean streak. Landry was indeed big, his arms widened by years of batting practice, but he carried himself unimposingly, with a rodent's nimble, nibbly destructiveness. His cruelties were either vocal, his wit wasn't sharp, but like a chainsaw could gash you just the same, where they were stealthy and prankish. In eighth grade, after a girl suffered the misfortune of experiencing her first menstrual period during class, he allegedly sneaked into the classroom after school and dribbled red acrylic paint across her seat. More than once, rumor had it, he'd accessed the girl's locker room to sneak beef bouillon cubes into the shower heads so the girls showered in hot soup. If you were a girl who passed out at a party and woke to find a penis drawn on your face with a Sharpie, you could feel certain who'd done it. Girls weren't his only victims, however. Hazing had gotten so savage on the baseball team that earlier that year, two players had quit the team and the school board had had to intervene. Landry's father owned a seafood processing plant over by Keegan Bayou and was a big athletic booster. Gossip pointed to this as the reason Landry had emerged unscathed. Cameron was just scantly aware of all this, and at the moment, his own wits were dimming from the effect of the beers he'd funneled. His memory remains blurred. He recalls Landry shooting the shit about the coming football season, wanting to compare his predictions with those of Cameron, who's finding the conversation strained and a little weird, Landry grinning the whole time like maybe he was stoned. Then Landry curled his finger inward. Cameron frowned. Landry curled the finger again, inviting Cameron to lean in closer. Cameron did. He felt Landry's breath steaming his ear, his nose catching a yeasty, burpy whiff of beer. In a whisper, his bottom lip brushing Cameron's earlobe, Landry slowly sang, "Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a..." Cameron, jerking his head back, ignited in Landry's throat a blast of roaring laughter. It was laughter unlike any Cameron had ever heard, a hyena's maniacal shrieks blended with a coughing fit, something vicious and sickly about it all at once. Cameron watched Landry laugh with his hands beginning to clench at his sides. There'd never been a Christie or a Chris. Just Landry entertaining himself. Rich enough to possess a spare phone, getting his jollies off when the television lacked a decent baseball game, seeing how far he could take it. Half an hour later, Tommy Landry was in the emergency ward, his pulped face resembling a possum split open on the highway, while Cameron was sitting on a bench in a solitary holding cell at the Harrison County lockup, scraping dried blood from his fingers, a part of him wishing there was more to scrape. Nothing ended after that, except Cameron's high school football career. 3 games into the season, and 2 games after he tied a school record for the most receiving yards in a single game. The reason he gave for quitting was his mother's death, and while there was truth to that, it wasn't the entire truth. The sudden distance his teammates put between themselves and him, the averted glances, the mumbly chill that seemed to follow him into the locker room. Cameron felt sure that Landry had outed him, probably before, but maybe after the beach beating, and he was further dismayed that no one on the team had enough doubts to confront him about it, or enough loyalty to stand up for him, or at least let him know. There's no evidence, however, to suggest Landry ever did take his catfishing exploits public. 6 of Cameron's former teammates say they never heard any rumors about Cameron being gay. One of the team's running backs, Montrell Davis, speculates that Landry would have had a difficult time defending his investigative methods. "Okay, so Cameron might be gay," he imagines himself responding to Landry. "But you posing as a girl, and then a guy for all that time? That makes you some kind of psycho, man." Moreover, Davis goes on, Landry would have likely had to field questions about how it feels to get your ass whooped by a gay guy. "I don't know that I want to say this, because that was a nasty beating that night. But Cameron opening his can of whoop-ass was probably the best thing he could have done to stay on the down-low." Something important to note. Tommy Landry refuses to confirm the substance and or details of Cameron's account. But despite repeated invitations to do so relayed through his attorney, he also doesn't deny them. "Thing was, man," Davis goes on, "Cameron was our brother, you know? He was our teammate. And to be real frank about it, he was a lot of the reason we were putting up scores. So gay or not, man, it wouldn't have mattered. I mean that. We would have rallied around him. We would have circled the motherfucking wagons. If some guys had a problem with it, well, that would have been their problem." Whether this reflects the truth of the atmosphere more than a decade ago, or is just the voice of mature enlightenment, is impossible to know. Another former teammate is far more circumspect.
I'm not saying I would have had a problem with that, but yeah, I might have had a problem with that. I think the school would have had to figure out something with the showers and all that, would have had to build something separate for him.
Coach Niekase, who retired in 2011, admits the team's adjustment would have been rocky.
That would have been a new one on me, after 31 years of coaching.
But that, as Cameron's coach, he would have stood by him 110%. Cameron finds this more troubling than heartening to hear. What it suggests to him is that, with a dash more courage and faith in his teammates, he could have kept playing football, and perhaps gone on to a very different life. Perhaps college instead of the army, and on to wherever college leads. But what troubles him also is that he just doesn't buy it. Not the generous hindsight from Davis and Niekase. Not even the part about Landry staying silent. Landry had the drop on him, and 10 years later showed no reluctance to shouting it on camera in a crowded barroom. Why would he have kept it to himself back then? Unless, per Davis's theory, Cameron essentially punched his mouth closed.
If he sends some kind of chill like he's saying, Davis says of Cameron, it's because his mama just got killed, and then he'd gone and beat the shit out of our center fielder and nobody knew why. I don't think anyone knew what to say to him. We just put our heads down and focused on playing ball.
The only person in whom Cameron confided was Jim Yarbrough, his mother's boyfriend. Jim was guiding him through the youth court briars, and wasn't accepting Cameron's vague explanation about being drunk and overreacting to a comment he couldn't even remember. Cameron had always liked Jim. The best thing you could hope for in life, he remembers thinking, was for someone to look at you the way his mom looked at Jim. But their shared grief had endowed them with a thicker and more enduring bond, mutual scar tissue. It had been Jim holding Cameron's arm at Debbie's graveside service, who'd steadied him as he tottered and swayed. And Cameron trusted Jim. Maybe it was Jim's professional-grade poker face, but he struck Cameron as someone skilled in keeping secrets. So he let it all come flowing, Christy morphing into Chris, everything, and watched as Jim nodded along, unfazed, his eyebrows rising at Landry's actions, but never Cameron's. It was far from the first thing he brought up, but at some point Jim asked,
"So you like guys?"
"I don't know what I like," Cameron said.
Jim twirled a pencil between his fingers.
"It'll probably make life easier for you if you figure that out, don't you think?"
"What if I do?" Cameron pleaded. "Like guys, I mean."
"Then I reckon you decide to go with that and call it a day," he said,
tapping the eraser end of the pencil on the table twice, as though brokering a very straightforward deal between Cameron and his sexuality.
"A leopard's got spots," he went on. "Now, he can pretend he don't, and hide up in a tree, or out in some high grass somewhere. But he ain't gonna live very well or very long that way, and he's still gonna have those spots."
Cameron tried absorbing this advice, which sounded wise to him at the time. But wise or not, what Jim gave him was ultimately just a metaphor. Cameron wasn't a leopard. He was a 16-year-old kid who was desperately hoping that his variety of spots, like a fawn's, might fade with time, that his attraction to males was something he might outgrow, or possibly will into oblivion. Hurricane Katrina came whirling in the next summer, and when it was over, Cameron's exterior and interior landscape seemed to him bleakly aligned. Smashed, scoured, waterlogged, every familiar signpost washed straight out to sea. Driving down the beach, when U.S. 90 reopened, he sometimes found it impossible to orient himself. It was all just drifted sand and naked slabs, and as the dozers moved in, identical debris mounds. A few homes set back from the beach remained standing but hollowed out, like locust skins. All the talk elsewhere was of New Orleans, but that was because New Orleans had villains for its story, governmental malfeasance, racist urban engineering, while Mississippi had only wind and water, elements unimpeachable, the shapeless consequence of what insurance adjusters marked down as an act of God. Hearing people talk about a new normal on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, though, Cameron found a sneer curling his lip. He'd never known there was an old normal. What the new normal meant for Cameron was a hard and dirty existence. He hammered, he sawed, he nailed, he screwed, he drilled. He ascended ladders under the murderous sun with bundles of roofing shingles doubled up on his right shoulder, pack-muling close to his own weight in sticky asphalt mats. He wrested sheets of plywood into place and affixed them with a compressor-powered nail gun, the gun thwacking, then hissing, droplets of Cameron's sweat soaking into the parched layers of pine. He ripped into mildewed wall studs with a reciprocating saw, relishing the lurching violence of the blade, the way its machine gun jactitation got disseminated through his body. A scraggly flaxen beard took shape on his face, a pioneer's beard, sparse and unkempt, and his skin turned the brown of a paper shopping bag. He was 18, then 19, and no longer spurred by a yearning for love. Into the vacated zone once filled by that yearning came a great flume of lust. At the top of the ladder, he would pitch himself forward to slap the shingle bundles onto the tar paper, and then pause to take in the tableau before him. Stingingly erotic, his shirtless Mexican co-workers, like glistened dancers moving on a hot black stage. Sometimes they would notice him staring and mock him in Spanish, and he would tell them to shut up, that he was just tired. But below the roofline, his body was anything but tired. It was alive with something that refused to be stifled, that held his dreams hostage that night, and that sometimes felt driven by little more than dark mischief, dragging bait before him that he felt incapable of resisting, despite the glint of a hook. His new normal wasn't normal, just as the old normal hadn't been. He remembers the first time the military came into his head as an option. He was working in Gulfport, framing out a commercial addition on a building overseen by a giant billboard. It was an army recruiting sign, five soldiers inviting onlookers to become one of them. The billboard's cast was as diverse as an old Benetton ad. Two white guys, an Asian, a black guy, a Hispanic-looking woman. Yet in their matching dress uniforms, Cameron noted a sameness that reminded him, soothingly and appealingly, of football, and caused him to wonder if an army uniform could make him feel the way his football uniform had, apart from himself, folded into something larger, unidentifiable as anything other than a man assigned with a particular task, be it pulling passes from the air in a cheer-thundered stadium, or defending whatever his country wanted defended. Peering up at that billboard, one hand raised in an inadvertent salute meant to shield his eyes from the sun, Cameron wasn't thinking about combat, about killing or being killed, as he wasn't thinking about mortar shells and roadside bombs or the conical copper-jacketed bullets that an AK-47 can spew 10 per second, as he wasn't thinking about blood and fear and sorrow and pain and the raw white winters of the Hindu Kush, and as he most definitely wasn't thinking, not even maybe, about falling in love. Chapter 19. When Staff Sergeant DeMarcus Lockwood touched down at the landing zone at Forward Operational Base Barmal on August 6, 2009, the sleeve of his dress blues already bore six gold combat stripes. At 26 years old, Lockwood had served a previous tour in Afghanistan as well as two in Iraq, having been part of the invading force into Iraq in 2003. Before that, on the morning of September 11, 2001, he'd been a freshman at what was then called Mars Hill College near Asheville, North Carolina, and a third-string back on the school's Division II football team. But soon thereafter, by his own electing, he was neither a student nor an athlete, but an enlistee in the United States Army. His rarely glimpsed father had fought in the first Gulf War, and the grandfather who raised him, whom he'd always called Chief, served two combat tours in Vietnam before becoming a zealous amateur historian of the U.S. military's frontier wars with the Cherokee. If there was anything consistent in his DNA, Lockwood gathered, it was fighting prowess, something his steady 7-year rise through the ranks seemed to affirm. He was career-track by this point, a lifer in the pipeline, and though he was still years shy of his first gray hair, Lockwood possessed that alertly grizzled bearing that comes from being shot at numerous times. He looked like a man vulnerable to few, if any, kind of surprises. The lieutenant stood waiting for him at the landing pad, and immediately after Lockwood finished scurrying with his ruck down the Chinook's ramp, the helicopter rose and banked,